Blog Talk Radio.
You have heard of Jalop, if you heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along. Smart and designed, black convertible top, and the gals don't mind. Going with me, riding all around town for joy. Blow your horn, Raymond, blow! In my rocket and don't be late, baby, we're pulling out about half past eight. Going round the corner and get a feel for everybody in my car's gonna take a little nip. Move on out, oozing and cruising along.
James Bostic here, conservative perspective, and man, I'm glad to be here. Feeling good. It's going to be a good evening this evening. Our friend Michael Cutler is back with us. I'm happy about that. So you better buckle up and maybe even find a helmet if you know what's good for you. About a year and a half ago, I had the pleasure of going to a political event called Rock the Red down in Greenville, South Carolina. Mr. Presley Stutz, the organizer of that thing, and it was my chance to see the elephant, as they say. I wanted to go to one of these political confabs, see what was going on, and it also gave me an opportunity to meet meet good friends, Donna Fiducia and Don Newen. They've been podcasting associates of mine for many years now, and many of the good things that have flowed to me through podcasting, and they're responsible for, and I'm very grateful for that. Saturday night, this particular event, after dinner, there was a confab that took place within the confab, and Michael Cutler was there, Claire Lopez, Trevor Loudon, Don and Donna Fiducia, Don Newen, Donna Fiducia, myself, and it was just fantastic. It was just fantastic, and obviously we're talking about politics, and the subject came up to George W. Bush, and off to my left, I heard the acerbic, wry New York voice say, "What? Me worry?" And of course, that was Michael Cutler. And I knew exactly who he was talking about. And he was making the reference to the fact that W looks like Alfred E. Newman. And it tickled me. I got the joke. Mike and I shared a laugh about that. And then we started talking about politics. But what really rooted this acquaintance, his acquaintanceship with us, somehow the subject got on to NASA. And that lit a fire under Mike and myself, and that was where the conversation stayed for the rest of the evening. Forget politics. We had bigger fish to fry, and we had a terrific time talking about all those legends in space exploration. And from that, we have been blessed with the knowledge and the expertise and the explanations from someone I consider to probably be America's foremost authority on immigration, albeit illegal or otherwise. He was a federal agent for 30 years, Immigration Naturalization Services. His expertise moves into the areas of drug enforcement, organized crime, and counterterrorism as they would pertain to illegal immigration. It gives me great pleasure to spend the next 2 hours jawboning with one of the best guys out there, Mr. Michael Cutler. Michael, welcome, my friend.
Hey, James. It's always great to speak to you, to chat with you. And my goodness, what me worry, Mad Magazine. I mean, my gosh.
That was a good one.
but you have to understand that both political parties have become so corrupted by money, by power. I'm thinking of writing an article and reprising a title that I used years ago when I wrote a piece. And I think you might like it. I want to call it Governing Under the Influence. You know, it's dangerous to be driving under the influence. It's at least as dangerous to be governing under the influence. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. And we have them. And then so many of these guys in Washington, like, they're absolutely drunk. They're intoxicated with power.
They're intoxicated with power. They're intoxicated with money. You know, as a federal agent, I was not allowed to accept a cup of coffee on duty. Think about that. And in fact, I work closely with the Israeli National Police. We've probably discussed it before, but for your audience, my very first fraud investigation, I was a new kid on the block. And when you're a new agent, they're not going to give you a major case. You know, think about it. If you're a junior partner in a law firm, if you're a guy on the shop floor building cars, you're not going to get the most sensitive or difficult jobs. You're going to get the easy jobs. And mostly you work with a senior partner at your side to mentor you, to evaluate you, and frankly, to decide whether or not they should retain you, because during that first year, you have no tenure. At any time, they could tap you on the shoulder and say, Mr. Cutler, you're a nice guy, but this is not your cup of tea. Please give back the key to the men's room and head out the door, you know? So it's a period of adjustment, a period of training, a period of evaluation. And, I mean, very often they would have us get the radios and the cars fixed. We had two-way radios, or do mundane things, or back somebody else up that was making an arrest. And one day my boss calls me in. I was getting close to the end of my first year as an agent, and I already spent 4 years as an inspector, so I wasn't completely a novice or a newbie. I had already been to Border Patrol Academy. And my boss called me and he said, Mike, you're doing real well. It would appear that, you know, we are going to retain you as an agent. Good news for you. We have a young man who came in at the airport from Israel last night. He had an altered visa. Go take a statement from him. If he doesn't want to talk to you, just put a memo in the file. If he does, we want to see how you do taking a statement without anybody at your side, because as an agent, you're going to be doing a lot of these. Time for you to solo. And I did a little single-engine flying as a kid, you know, my love of aviation and space program that you alluded to. In fact, as a kid, I got letters from Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom. I wouldn't trade those letters for any sports memorabilia in the world. And I've had the privilege of meeting some of our nation's astronauts, Jim Lovell, Dave Scott, Jim McDivitt. And last year when I spoke in Washington before a bunch of Air Force generals, one of the people in the audience was Jack Fisher, a current astronaut who had just come back from the space station. So, you know, big deals for me. But in any event, I was told to basically take my first solo flight, you know, once around the pattern and then land, okay? Go take a statement, see how you make out. And I sat this young man down. He was very affable, spoke flawless English. But as we got to speaking, the hair on my neck started to stand up. He was from the West Bank. He kept calling Israel Palestine. And I said, whoa, something is up with this. So I started to question him, and he lied through his teeth about the visa. It was obvious that the visa had been altered. The visa was originally valid for a single entry, and the number one was changed to the number two, He had already been admitted once on the visa. So rather than get a new visa, he or one of his confederates altered the number one to the number two and changed the year of expiration so that the visa would appear to still be current. But under a black light, the thing lit up like Times Square. And as a New Yorker, I could tell you, Times Square can be bright. And this thing was all lit up. And so I knew he was lying. Question of why was he lying? Why was he here? And my immediate assumption back then, oh, he's here to work. That was the biggest concern that we had. I actually find it remarkable that today when you hear these governors say, well, we have to give driver's licenses to the undocumented. How else could they get to work? They're not supposed to be here. They're certainly not supposed to be working. The Labor Department used to run immigration prior to the Second World War. And the issue was to protect jobs and wages of Americans, especially as we were coming out of the Depression. That was something that Roosevelt was, you know, all fired up about. No American should have to compete with a foreign worker. What a novel thought. And in fact, as a new agent, if we found an alien who entered under a tourist visa or a student visa working in a factory, and they always talk about visa overstays. Well, let's say the guy came in last week and now he's working and he has 6 months to stay here. We would arrest him. The handcuffs go on. He gets tossed in the back seat and he sees the judge the next day because you don't have the right to work on a tourist visa. That's why it's a tourist visa. So the notion we have to give them licenses so they get to their jobs, they're stealing the jobs of Americans and lawful immigrants. Think about that level of betrayal and stupidity and how Americans don't get it. Oh, they do the work Americans won't do. Sure thing. My dad was a construction worker. He was a tradesman. And for him and his buddies, no job was too dangerous, too filthy, or too backbreaking. It was a day's work. And when I go by construction jobs to this day and I smell that freshly dug earth, and I see these guys coming off the job with their lunch pails, I almost catch myself looking for my dad. Tragically, I lost him to lung cancer when I was 19. He was 57, in part because he smoked what I call blowtorches, those Chesterfields. But he also worked in the Navy shipyards during the Second World War to defend America. He tried to enlist. They wouldn't take him because his older brother was already in the Army Air Corps. And back then, if you were the sole surviving male member of your family, because of the Sullivan brothers, they wouldn't take you. So, tragically, my dad died when I was 19. Huge loss. But I still stand on his shoulders and my mom's shoulders, who died a year later of breast cancer. And I learned how to take care of myself because I had parents who taught me responsibility. Nothing is going to be handed to you, they told me. And I'll be honest with you, when I look at all this thing about the issues of racism, I'm Jewish, and unfortunately, I've encountered dumb people who are anti-Semitic. There are people who hate other people because they're stupid. And anti-Semitism was what the Holocaust was about, and I was named for my mother's mother, who couldn't get out of Poland, and because of her religion, our religion, she was killed by the Nazis. So we've got to stop the hatred from every direction. And when we hear anyone talking about whites versus black, this is a dangerous game that's being played. And my parents told me if you encounter anti-Semitism, the solution, as ugly and disgusting as it is, study hard, work hard, be so good at whatever it is you do for a living that people that may not like you will have to respect you. They will be compelled to hire you, and they will have to pay you a living wage out of a recognition of your talent, ability, and commitment. And that's how I've lived my life. That's how I raised my children. We have four honors kids. Two of my boys are engineers. One's a teacher. My daughter has her degree in English. It's about education and achievement. But this whole business, I know I digress, but this whole business about Americans looking at each other and making decisions based on what I call superficial elements, race, religion, ethnicity, it's un-American in Mike Cutler's judgment. It's dangerous. And it's something that we should be upset and concerned about and push back with words and with logic. When I say push back, I want to be clear about it. There's far too much violence out there, and innocent people are being hurt. We're really tearing ourselves apart as a country, and our enemies are standing on the sidelines licking their chops. what we really should be focused on is what makes us the most similar, not what makes us the most different. And as Americans, goodness, you know, I have to tell you, James, I've come to consider you a good friend. And I'm going to guess you're a Southern Baptist. I'm Jewish. You're from a small town. I'm from one of America's biggest cities, perhaps the biggest city. And I see you as a kindred spirit. And that's how all Americans should be viewing each other. I'm pretty sure you're going to agree with me on this, James. Am I getting anything wrong here?
No, absolutely. You and I, indeed, we come from divergent environments. We really do. But that never kept us from sitting down. I mean, Democrat, Republican, if you really want to get totally polarized, but it didn't keep you and I from sitting down and enjoying one another's company. And if there is a difference, we talk about it. And if we disagree, so what?
But that's our birthright to disagree. When you're told you're not allowed to disagree, you're no longer a free human being. The hallmark of freedom is the right to disagree. We should do it respectfully. It should be based on fact, not nonsense. But my goodness, this whole business with woke. And you know, I love this idea. I'd like to have the folks that are running around making all the noise think about how woke China is with the Uyghurs and all the other nonsense that they've been doing in China. We're weakening ourselves in front of an enemy that has no respect for human rights, no respect for difference of opinion, no respect for anything but their own need for power. If you want to talk about governing under the influence, look no further than China, okay? But anyway, to get back to this point that I was making about my first case, when this young man told me that he was from the West Bank, he kept referring to Israel as Palestine, I asked him about military service. He claimed he didn't understand the question after speaking with him for over a half hour with no hiccups in the conversation whatsoever. That alarmed me. I brought in a translator, and she started to question him in Hebrew. And when we got to the question about military, he claimed even in Hebrew he couldn't understand what she was asking. She flipped to Arabic. She was from Israel originally, spoke English and Hebrew and Arabic fluently, and he freaked out and locked up all four wheels and refused to continue the conversation. At this point, I called up the Israeli consulate, and I said, you have a citizen here, and I'm concerned about him. He comes from an area where we know you have conflict. He's referring to Israel as Palestine. He would not explain or answer the question about military service, and in Israel, there's universal conscription. Even people who are in wheelchairs, put on a uniform and answer phones or serve some other purpose for the government to maintain the security of the state of Israel, something very important when you're surrounded by enemies as they are. Well, long story short, as they were interviewing him, I noticed, if they came down to talk to him, I noticed that his shirt wasn't fitting properly. And this was the shirt that he wore when he came in at the airport. Back then, this was 1976. They didn't wear orange jumpsuits at our detention center. They wore the street clothing that they had with them. He was wearing the shirt that he came to the airport with the day before, but it didn't sit right. There was something wrong with it. I asked him to take it off. He didn't want to. I explained to him that since he was in custody, as a matter of security, he's subject to strip search. And I said, so either you're going to take the shirt off or I'm going to take it off, but one way or another, that shirt's coming off. Well, he finally reluctantly rolled up the shirt and threw it at me. And then I realized why he didn't want me to see it. There was a pocket sewn inside the shirt, and in the pocket was a piece of paper with an ink drawing, a schematic, with Arabic writing. Well, I can't read Arabic, but I knew the Israelis probably would, because two of the people that came, three came, the consul general and two security people, who I found out later were part of their intelligence network. It turned out that this diagram was a diagram of an oil refinery in Israel. It was a plan to get past the perimeter, plant explosives, and blow it up. Just stop and think about the enormity of that. And this was my introduction to the nexus between immigration and terrorism. And my relationship with the Israelis after that was probably as good as it could get. I was told I was the only American not only allowed to walk through their consulate in New York without an escort, but with my firearm. And we worked closely. They had instances where fugitives fled to the United States, including one guy wanted for murder. We went out, we arrested him, sent him back to Israel, and he was put on trial and found guilty of murdering a Palestinian prostitute. So we did a lot of work together. The Israelis sent police officers to sit on our wiretaps when we investigated Israeli drug traffickers, because we couldn't understand, even our translators wouldn't have been able to understand the Hebrew they used slang. But their police officers certainly could understand them. So they actually sent us a team of police officers to sit on the wiretaps so that they gave us 24-hour coverage. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better working relationship. And what it taught me was how integral immigration is to everything that we face. Bad guys travel around the world to evade detection, to engage in training, to make deals, to move people in contraband. It all involves crossing borders. In fact, the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, made it abundantly clear that border security is national security. But neither party has ever wanted to address the issue. Think about that. Ronald Reagan gave us the first amnesty. Ronald Reagan gave us this dangerous visa waiver program that has been expanding ever since, even after 9/11. Ronald Reagan gave us the diversity visa. So when I hear people talk about the Democrats and the Republicans, they say, hold on a second. George W. Bush, and this is why I had such disdain for Bush, and I was told that every time I testified before Congress, and I did something like 17 hearings in the House and Senate, I was told every time that he was told that I was in front of Congress, he would, you know, light up like the 4th of July. And I was told that when my name was quoted or brought up at the Oval Office, he would curse obscenities. I only wish I had a video clip. What he did was so dangerous. And what he did was amazing. When he created the Department of Homeland Security, he cut immigration in half. That was never supposed to happen. The enabling legislation was the Homeland Security Act. And the Homeland Security Act said that in the wake of 9/11, we know that immigration was the key failing that enabled not only the 9/11 hijackers, but other terrorists to enter the United States, hide in plain sight, and carry out attacks. We need to enforce the immigration laws. We need to ramp this up because it is extremely important for national security. And along comes George W. Bush after 9/11, and he was in office on 9/11. Just stop and think about the enormity of this. And he took immigration and he cut enforcement in half, which made it completely unwieldy. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and Customs and Border Protection. They should have been part of one agency. In fact, I testified in November of 2001 before the Immigration Reform Caucus in the House, chaired by then Congressman Tom Tancredo. And I talked about the need for what I call the enforcement tripod, the immigration enforcement tripod. And what I envisioned was that we would spin off the section that adjudicates applications for various benefits, citizenship, green cards, political asylum, and so forth. And I was an adjudicator for a year. One of the advantages that I have is that I served in so many different positions. So when I speak about these issues, it's not conjecture. It's not because a hair grew out of my ear and I think I know what I'm talking about. I spent a year as an adjudications officer doing those marriage interviews. And I could tell you some pretty funny stories. It was a great training opportunity to learn how to do a meaningful interview, seriously. And I spent 4 years as an inspector at the airport. And then I was an agent, and I rotated through all the squads within the investigations branch. In fact, in 1988, I became the first INS agent who was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of DEA in New York, the Drug Enforcement Administration. And that went real well. And I was reluctant to leave, but I put in for a promotion at the behest of people at headquarters, because they loved the work I did when I was at Intel, and they said, put it for 13. Now, a GS-13 in the military, the equivalent grade is lieutenant colonel. And who could turn down a promotion if it's possible? So I put in for a promotion, and I was promoted, and I was assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. So I had desks at the FBI, DEA, ATF. I got to work with foreign governments, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, British Customs, New Scotland Yard. I got an award from the Japanese government, and I continued working with the Israelis on cases of mutual interest. So I truly wound up with a global perspective, and I understood how integral immigration is to everything, how border security is to everything. And just to give you an example, we've all seen those World War II movies where you got a bunch of commandos bumping through a stormy sky in the back of a DC-3, right? And they got their parachutes on and they're carrying their rifles and they jump out of the airplane to get behind enemy lines. It's almost a cliched scene, isn't it, by now?
Yes, I think so, but...
Okay, so for those of you, even like Captain America, there's a great scene where Captain America jumps out to save prisoners of war that are held behind enemy lines. You know, today, as we speak, people are getting on airplanes to get behind enemy lines. They are. They're not carrying parachutes. They're not carrying their rifles. But they're landing at international airports as passengers. Because to America's enemies, getting behind enemy lines means getting past the border of the United States of America. Think about that analogy. In fact, when I've addressed members of the armed forces, I'm privileged that I work with the Speakers Bureau, so I frequently get to address generals and colonels and so forth in the Air Force. They've been in front of people from the Navy and other branches of our government, including intelligence services. I say, you know, the purpose of all of our branches of the armed forces is to keep, the primary mission is to keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible. But up close and in person, that critical job then is passed to the Border Patrol and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Think about it. And on 9/11, that point was hammered home as hard as it could ever be. And Bush knew this. And when I testified for Tancredo, I said, look, the adjudicators need to be off in a separate realm because we had district directors who were adjudicators telling agents what to do under the old Immigration and Naturalization Service, and these were people who had zero law enforcement background. So how do you have an administrator running an office, including federal agents, who's never made an arrest in his or her life, never carried a gun, has no idea about what happens when you go in front of a grand jury? I mean, this is a mess. And I said, so the benefits side, the adjudicators need to be spun off, and we need to closely coordinate what the Border Patrol does, what the inspectors at international airports do, and what the agents do. That's why I called it the tripod. The inspectors enforce the laws at ports of entry, a job, again, that I'm very familiar with, did it for 4 years. The Border Patrol enforces the laws between ports of entry. Their primary mission is interdiction, very important. And finally, the special agents comprise the third leg of the tripod, and that's always been the ignored and neglected leg. It's a very short leg. There's only 6,000 ICE agents right now, for example, and most of the work they're doing has nothing to do with immigration, thanks to George W. Bush, because he blended immigration in with customs, immigration and customs enforcement. And then he added to that TSA, and then he added to that Secret Service. And then he added to that ATF. So wait a minute. Why are all these other agencies under the same roof that's supposed to enforce immigration law? And then Bush made sure that most of the people that he put in positions of leadership had zero, none, no immigration experience whatsoever. What could possibly go wrong? And this was what George W. Bush did. So he sent BORTAC units, which are the elite members of the Border Patrol, Border Patrol tactical teams, under his, quote, leadership, unquote. He sent them to Iraq to secure the Iraqi border and left our border open. And in fact, I don't know if you remember that horrible story, but a bunch of armed drug dealers coming across the border from Mexico, we had National Guardsmen on the border. Now, they're not allowed to do law enforcement. Their job is just to back up the Border Patrol, take care of non-law enforcement functions, but they backed away from these intruders and they were invited to be given medals for backing away. Think about the madness. And then you had Ramos and Copian, two Border Patrol agents who were doing their job on the border, engaged a smuggler. They wound up shooting him. They didn't think they hit him, but they did report the shooting to their superiors. Nevertheless, they were criminally prosecuted and spent years in jail. For doing what? Securing the border against a drug dealer. And this guy had been arrested previously and subsequently, and initially that exculpatory information, which should have been disclosed to the attorneys representing these two Border Patrol agents, never knew about it until way after the trial. Thank you, George W. Bush. So if I sound like I have no use for George W. Bush, you got it right. You got it right. It's both parties that have done this to us. It was Donald Trump who finally stood up and said, let's secure the border, and everybody freaked out. Why? Because neither party wants the border secure. Be clear about this in your mind, ladies and gentlemen. This is not a left-right issue. When the Republicans controlled both the House and Senate, what happened to Trump's request for money to build the border wall? Never got it. They never hired more ICE agents. Why? Because, and I wrote about this for a publication. I'm now writing for two publications. I've been writing for, gosh, about 6 or 7 years for the David Horowitz Freedom Center Front Page magazine. I'm very proud of my affiliation with Front Page and with David Horowitz. And most recently, I've been writing for the American Conservative. And my most recent article for the American Conservative, let me just pull this one up for you. Biden amps up the immigration delivery system, because that's what immigration has become. We are constantly told by the journalists, so-called journalists, and by the politicians, the immigration system is broken. And every time I hear it, you have to laugh. I mean, most people think that. When I do a speaking engagement, I'll ask people, raise your hand if you think the immigration system is broken. Every hand goes up. And I said, well, how do you know it's broken? Well, look at all these illegals who are here. I said, what are we doing about it? And this is even before Biden. I mean, what Biden has done is outrageous. And now he's blaming Trump. It's like when we used to arrest people, they would blame a crime on some other guy. I didn't do it. He did it. Right? Right? The finger pointing. Well, that's what Biden and this administration are doing. So here's my contention. First of all, let's dissect the lies. We can't arrest 11 million illegals, and that number is totally bogus. Yale University did a study about 3 years ago and estimated there's at least double that number of illegals. I think it's way higher than that. And Reagan played the same game. Reagan sold his amnesty, which is part of the Immigration Reform and Control Act. Oh, there's about a million. We'll finally get everything back to zero, and then everything will be great because we'll have control. Sure thing. Never hired the agents. So the 1 million that they told us were here morphed into almost 4 million. And the magic number that nobody talks about, how many people got green cards once we legalized nearly 4 million illegal aliens? Nobody knows because nobody's ever investigated it. We are clueless. But let's say each alien on average had 4 children. So now the 4 million brings in 16 million. Biden is talking about legalizing 11 million. Let's say it's 25 million. I'm being conservative. I think the numbers are way higher. I think just like with Reagan, it's nearly 4 times what they claim. 4 times 11 million is 44 million. Some people say 30, 35. I'm going to be an optimist and say 25 million. But if they each have on average 4 children, just stop and think about this one, they would then be able to bring in 100 million children. Let that number sink in, 100 million children who would immediately be enrolled in schools. They need more than a pillow to sleep on. They need water and food. They need electricity. They need sewerage. They need health care. They need transportation. They need clothing. Inflation would go through the roof, supply and demand, all these mouths to feed. Suddenly the price of food goes up. We have water shortages in parts of the country as it stands. Imagine what bringing in 100 million people would do to that. And when these kids grow up and they start working, we now have 100 million workers that need jobs. And you put them in school. And if they don't speak, read, or write English, back in 2006, the Congressional Budget Office did a study that said that it costs 20 to 40% more to educate children who can't speak, read, or write English. Great news for our school systems that are crumbling, especially after COVID. So imagine what we're talking about. So we're told you can't deport 11 million. The best we can do is legalize them. Why is that? And it's amazing, and this goes back to Goebbels and the Holocaust and the tactics of the Third Reich. It was called the big lie. You tell a lie, and it's got to be a whopper. I mean, a stupendous whopper. Not just a little lie, but a blatant, humongous, the size of, you know, gargantua. and just keep repeating it. Give it a couple of weeks, and everyone will think that that lie is the truth. Do you know how many times, James, I've stood in front of a room, and we talk about this, and they say, well, Mr. Cutler, what do you do with the aliens you can't arrest? We can't arrest 11 million. I mean, it's a pathetic question because no one's thinking. How many people do you know violate motor vehicle laws when they drive? I broke the law today. I admit it. I speeded. Speed limit was 20. I was doing 28. Was I speeding? Sure. Did they catch me? Nope. So what do you do with the people you don't catch? You don't do anything with them. You catch as many as you can. You punish them if you catch them. And you make it clear to everybody that if we catch you breaking the law, you will suffer consequences. That's what you do. Think about that. How many people out there have driver's licenses and like a good drink? Okay. So do you think we have enough cops to arrest every drunk driver? Of course not. Do you think we have enough cops to pull over everybody that pulls out a cell phone and is dumb enough to text while driving? I really don't get that one at all. I mean, I have, you know, voice texting on my phone. I have a speakerphone in my car, and I could send James a text, you know, tell Siri to tell James I'm happy to be on the show today, right? And you get a text, and I never picked up my phone. But you have idiots that'll be there with their phone in their hand, even though it's illegal. So what do the police do? They have very effective campaigns to convince you that if you reach for the phone, SWAT is going to descend on your car, and they're going to yank you through your sunroof, right? It's a game of psychological warfare. If we catch you, you're not going to have a good day. True or false?
Absolutely.
Right, James? Okay. So
Absolutely. That's
what you do with illegal aliens. You make it clear that if you violate the law and we catch you, you're not going to be happy. We used to require aliens in January to fill out an address report card. And if you watched TV back then, they always said, remember, January is alien report month. Go to the local post office if you're an alien and fill out a card. Reagan ended that process. What is wrong with knowing where people are if they're not supposed to be in your country? When I go into a business, a building, whether it's a government building or a corporate building, you go to the front desk, they ask the CID, they give you a security tag, and they tell you it's only good on the 12th and 13th floor, you can't go anywhere else, and if you try, they'll throw you out of the building because you're only a guest in that building, okay? You're a visitor. Well, you're a visitor when you come to America, and other countries have no problem telling you, if you violate the law, we're going to send you home. If you go to a bar and you become obstreperous, the bouncer is going to deposit you at the sidewalk. And think of what happened when those rioters attacked the Capitol. They're calling it an insurrection. I would argue it was simply riot, not an insurrection. The only death, by the way, was of an unarmed Air Force veteran by a federal officer whose identity has never been divulged. Isn't that kind of interesting? We have no idea who shot that woman. Now, I certainly am sympathetic to federal officers. I carried a badge for 30 years. But you're responsible and accountable. And I remember getting firearms training, and I had to qualify every 90 days. They always told us, if you're ever in a shootout, and thankfully I never was, came close a bunch of times, and I was so relieved that we never got to that point of pulling the trigger. But if you do pull the trigger, and you pull the trigger multiple times, let's say you're in a shootout, and you fire off 8 rounds. The first 7 are textbook perfect. The 8th one is determined to have been improper. You could find yourself in jail because every trigger pull is a separate investigation. It's called accountability, and I agree with it 100%. You don't just crank off rounds. We're not kids with cap pistols like we had as kids, okay? It's a serious matter. So they broke into the Capitol, and oh, my God, we're going to drop a bomb on these people. They broke into the Capitol. They trespassed. Well, what do aliens do when they're running our borders? Is that not trespass? Chuck Schumer recommended a federal law that would call for a maximum of 5 years in jail if anybody trespassed on national landmarks or critical infrastructure. He said, you know what? I don't care if you're an adrenaline freak or if you're a criminal. If you trespass, you're doing something dangerous, and you need to go to jail. And he even mentioned on his official Senate website a 16-year-old kid who climbed the World Trade Center that was under construction, the Freedom Tower, to take a selfie. Then he mentioned that kid and said, I don't care. He belongs in jail for 5 years for what he did. But the same Schumer and his buddies will tell you, but when you trespass on America, now you've earned citizenship. Think about the insanity. So if we can't deport 11 million, let's give them all citizenship. Really? Well, no, the Republicans don't want them to get citizenship, just the ability to work here and bring their families. If they get citizenship, they can vote, I guess. The Democrats, of course, want them to have citizenship so they can vote as soon as possible. So that's the dividing line. But neither party is saying, wait a minute, if you're here illegally, you need to go home. And think about all the mythology. These poor people need to be reunited with their families. I agree. I help reunite so many aliens with their families. Do you know that, James? Every day I worked, I struggled to see how many families I could reunite by sending illegal aliens back home to be with their families. Now we're doing it the other way around. Oh, you're an illegal alien and you miss your family? Well, bring them here for you. Imagine if someone broke into your house and you say to the guy, you okay? Yeah, I'm hungry. I'm tired. I need a bathroom. But I miss my wife. I don't know what she's doing. Well, call her up and have her join you. We'll set up the guest room for both of you. Have I lost my mind?
No, you haven't. It sounds like you have. But what you're talking about is absolutely, it's spot on. It's like, well, I was reading your article that you wrote here concerning Biden's pick of Chris Magnus, who is chief of police out in Tucson. 180 degrees opposite from what we need in that position. And he's doing it in government, you know, in positions all over the government.
Yes, he is. Now, here's the story about Chris, and I want your audience to understand this. Chris is the chief of police. The Border Patrol goes to Chris Magnus and says, you know what? We had a guy in custody, and he escaped. Can you please have your police officers help us? And we've done this all the time. In New York, I work closely with the NYPD, okay? Not anymore, I can tell you that. And Chris said, you enforce immigration law. We're not going to do that. If we enforce the immigration laws, the immigrants won't trust the police. So if you're looking for someone, you're on your own. We're not going to do a damn thing to help you with that. Lots of luck. And we want no part of that. So Chris Magnus is now going to be in charge of Customs and Border Protection. In other words, the inspectors at ports of entry and the entire U.S. Border Patrol will now answer, if he's confirmed, to a man who did everything he could to prevent the Border Patrol from doing its job. I mean, just stop and let the enormity of that sink in. Now, Chris Magnus will have a boss, if God forbid he's approved, and his name is Alejandro Mayorkas. Now, Mayorkas is an interesting character. I've known about him for a long time. He used to work for Mr. Obama. He was in charge of the Adjudications Division, United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, and I compare them to the locksmith of the United States. Let me tell you how critical this job is. What would you say, James, if I told you that if, and I know Biden has now said he stopped all construction on the border wall, it's done, it's finito. But let's say tomorrow morning he bumps his head and he goes off in a different direction. He's kind of like, you know, one of those robot vacuums that bounces all over the place because there's an image for you. He's kind of a rudderless vessel. He does what he's told to do. If you'll notice, it's not just that Secret Service stands right behind him. You've got Kamala Harris standing right behind him, making sure he doesn't go off script, I guess. I don't know what happens if he does go off script. Does she take out a rubber mallet and smack him in the head? I have no idea why she's always standing behind him. I've never seen that before.
He gets a blowgun dart in the neck.
I tell you, it's amazing. So anyway, let's say he said, we're going to finish the border wall, we know what the American people want, and we're going to coat it with Teflon and slather it with grease, and then we're going to run concertine wire on top of it and run 50,000 volts of electricity through that concertine wire. So That's a pretty impressive wall. But I could put something in your pocket, and it basically makes the wall evaporate. Could you imagine that? I could put something that fits in your pocket, and the wall basically goes away. What do you think I would have to put in your pocket?
A driver's license or a national ID of some kind.
A green card.
A green card.
All right? Now, think about this. The border wall is not designed to stop anybody from entering the United States. Another big lie. Oh, my God, Germany had a wall, the Berlin Wall. No, the Berlin Wall was to keep people in, not to keep people out, okay? Jails
yeah.
have walls. Yes, so does the White House, right? A little difference, right? Which way is the flow of people going? So, oh, my God, the wall of hate. You don't want Mexicans in America. I'm going to tell you, folks, and this is going to shock you, but that wall is not designed to stop a single person from entering the United States. Let it sink in. The border wall does not block off ports of entry. If the border wall blocked off ports of entry, I would agree. Then we built the wall to keep everybody from Latin America out. That's not the case. The ports of entry are wide open. The border wall is like the velvet rope at the bank that guides customers to the next available teller. Or better analogy, perhaps, it's like the cattle runs at the airport when you have to go to TSA. So, you know, they've got those nylon things on spools that act as barriers similar to the velvet rope. And you walk through there, through this cattle run maze. Until you get to the next available TSA person who checks your ID and makes sure you're not bringing a weapon on board the airplane. Okay. Well, here's my question. Would you get on an airplane if you saw people sneaking past TSA? I don't think so. But we're being told by the politicians that it's perfectly acceptable that we as Americans live in a country with millions of people who snuck past the vetting process we conducted ports of entry. This is insanity. So the border wall isn't designed to stop people from entering. It's just to make sure we have an orderly process so we do know who's coming in. That's why when we come to someone's front door, we knock on the door, we say, may I come in? And the homeowner looks through the little peephole and says, I don't like the looks of this guy. This guy Cutler is shady. I'm not letting him in. And they say, sorry, we're not home. Go somewhere else. Or they say, Mike, how are you? Come on in. Guess what? What that homeowner does is what I did for 4 years when I sat in that booth at Kennedy International Airport. In fact, when I helped Arizona with that lawsuit filed by the Obama Justice Department over SB 1070, the state immigration law, I described my four-year tenure at the airport as an inspector as the time that I had my eye to the peephole on America's front door. So that's all we're talking about. The wall is there to make certain that there's an orderly process and that nobody gets in without being inspected. If you sneak around to the back of your neighbor's house and climb in through the bedroom window, I don't think your neighbor's going to be very happy about that. When people try to get into our country by sneaking in, it's called trespass. And Schumer knows how to deal with trespass. He spent 5 years in jail. Unless you're an illegal alien, in which case we'll give you citizenship and free health care and free education, and we'll reunite you with your family.
And your
by
family.
Bringing them here.
Exactly.
Am I getting any of this wrong, James?
No, it's we're on the other. It seems for now that we're on the other side of the looking glass, Michael. Wrong is right, bad is good, and yeah, it's like everything is 180 degrees opposite of what it should be.
Yes, and people are accepting it. They say to me, you're anti-immigrant, right? Because Jimmy Carter started this BS. Oh, you can't use the word alien. They're immigrants. The word alien, if you go to Section 101 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, they have all the definitions, and every section of law has definitions. For example, ATF deals with firearms. How can you arrest somebody for possessing an illegal firearm if you don't define what a firearm is? So a firearm is a device that fires a bullet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, okay? What's a dangerous drug? Well, that's defined. Well, immigration laws define aliens, okay? An alien is simply defined as any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. Where's the insult? It doesn't say people who smell bad, people who are stupid, people who are immoral, people who are ugly. No. You're a citizen of a country other than America, and you're standing on our soil. That makes you an alien. It's like me telling James, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but you and I are not related. You're not a family member, but you're my friend. You see? That's what we're talking about. An alien comes to America, they're an alien. If we go to another country, under international law, we become an alien by virtue of standing on the ground of a country in which we are not citizens. That's what the word alien means. So why are they playing the game of semantics? I've been on a one-man campaign. This is not about being politically correct. Just that's a dangerous concept. Oh, you're trying to be polite. No. This isn't about being polite. This is Orwellian newspeak. We think with words, and when you can alter the words, you alter the thought process. So now if you say, you know, we need to make sure we keep people out of the country who could hurt us, oh, my God, Mike Cutler is anti-immigrant. Mr. Cutler, don't you know this nation was built by immigrants? Yes, but not by trespassers, you see. And yet you hear this all the time. And I'll tell you what, you can go to Fox News, you can go to all these conservative networks, so-called, and what will they say? They will define the debate as pro-immigrant or anti-immigrant, not pro-enforcement. And incidentally, if you're pro-enforcement, you are pro-immigrant because the same laws that tell us who to kick out, who to keep out, also tell us who to let in. And every year up until COVID, we've been admitting 1.1 million new immigrants. They're given green cards, and they're immediately placed on the path to citizenship. That's more than the rest of the world combined, under the very same laws that I enforced and administered as an immigration agent. As an adjudicator, I approved applications for green cards. I was happy to do it if it was apparent that the couple was living together and statutorily they had the right to get a green card. So Mayorkas ran that operation. That's how critical this is. You're giving people the keys to America's front door if you're an adjudicator. The 9/11 Commission was very clear. Immigration fraud, people lying on the applications, is the key method of entry and embedding, hiding in plain sight by the terrorists. The very first time I testified before Congress was way back on May 20th, 1997, on the issue of visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud because of two terror attacks carried out in the United States back in 1993. In January 93, a guy by the name of Kansi from Pakistan pulled into the parking lot of the CIA, pulled out an AK-47 and opened fire. By the way, the FBI just shot somebody to death who tried to do something similar 2 or 3 days ago. They reported today that he died from his injuries. So this is serious business. And then 1 month later, a truck loaded with a bomb was driven into the garage of the World Trade Center and detonated. The goal of the terrorists was to bring the building down sideways. Had they succeeded, it's estimated they might have killed over 100, 200,000, because remember, the Trade Center was 110 stories tall, 1,500 feet tall, two towers. And if one collided with the other, all that debris, and if the seawall had been ruptured and the Hudson River would have flooded lower Manhattan, I don't even know what the casualty count would have been. As it was, they killed 6 innocent people, injured over 1,000, and inflicted $500 million in damages. So in May of 1997, I was one of a number of people who was called to testify about immigration fraud because of concerns about how terrorists were gaming that process. And the Clinton administration basically did nothing. And then, in fact, in 1996, thereabouts, they implemented a program called CUSA, Citizenship USA, because the commissioner for the old INS, Doris Meisner, thought that her mission was to get as many aliens to come to America and become American citizens. She hated the enforcement people, hated the Border Patrol, hated the agent. And this is the commissioner under Clinton, okay? And she was active during the days of Reagan also. We need more people, open borders. Yeah, sure, the Chamber of Commerce. Let's bring competition for American workers, just what we needed. And so it's both parties. I want to be clear about this. So they've created this program. And it used to be that if you were adjudicating applications for citizenship, you had worked for the old INS for many years, and these were all lawyers. They were old guys. They'd been there forever, and their job was to make certain that we were careful as to who we gave citizenship to. In fact, the law said you're supposed to do good moral character investigations. It's remarkable. We're going to do a background check. Do you know what a background check is? Basically nothing. You run fingerprints and the name the alien gives you. That's a background check. A background investigation means you go out with a photograph, you knock on doors, you speak to neighbors, you speak to people where he worked. That's an investigation. It's the difference between putting your arm in a blood pressure cuff at the mall, if you still go to a mall, and comparing that with a full examination at a hospital for an annual physical. They're not the same. A background check is next to worthless. It's there to provide cover, to make it look good. Yes, we did a background check. Really? I had a top secret clearance. And every couple of years, they had investigators come in. In fact, when I first hired on, the FBI did it. Then it was given to private companies, probably because the private companies are making campaign contributions. And there was a big stink about how some of these companies did a really bad job and bad guys were getting security clearances. We always privatize. Privatizing is a way of laundering money. You know, not always, but all too often. So you give the contract to some outfit that probably gave a campaign contribution. Are there exceptions? Yes. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, but I've seen too much of this garbage going on. But they would come in and they would sit you down for several hours. I used to call it the bureaucratic equivalent of a proctoscope, okay, trying to clean this up. And there was no holds barred. They'd go to your neighborhood. They could pull up your bank records. They could pull up your phone records. That's a full background investigation, and it takes probably about a month to do it. A background check is done in about 8 minutes. So we took 1.1 million aliens during this program, CUSA, Citizenship USA, didn't even wait for the fingerprints to come back in many cases, and Meisner said, we don't have enough people to move all these applications. So they hired people off the street. I guess last week they were asking, would you like fries with that? And now they're asking, would you like to be a United States citizen? Think about the madness here. And they rushed all these applications through the process. And they threatened district directors that if you don't approve, forget about clear the backlog, if you don't approve a quota, we're going to fire you. You're senior executive service. You have no civil service protection. You will either move 3,000 applications per month, I believe was the number, and approve them, or we're going to fire you.
Holy cow.
All right?
That's insane.
It turns out, well, yes, and this happened under Clinton. So now, one of these people was a guy by the name of Mahmoud Abu Lima, who claimed that he got agricultural amnesty, and that was the invention of Chuck Schumer. And I met with Chuck back in 85 when he was pushing this. And I said, Chuck, he was my congressman, I said, why in the world are you concerned about agricultural workers when you don't have a farm in your district? He ended our meeting abruptly right there and then. Boom. Mr. Cutler, your time is up and my next appointment is here. You need to leave. Okay? So why is it that if someone worked on a farm, they're entitled to get a green card? Well, if you listen to Biden's speech, he's calling for it again. And Reagan implemented this thing. It was the Special Agricultural Worker Program, and I could read to you chapter and verse from the 9/11 Commission how many people lied on those applications. They never worked on a farm. And one guy in particular was Mahmoud Abu Lima, who came here, I believe, from Pakistan, claimed that he picked beans in Florida on a farm. We gave him amnesty as an agricultural worker. The only thing he ever planted was a bomb in the garage of the World Trade Center because he was involved. He was an integral part of the 93 bombing of the Trade Center. Okay? And I've said to members of Congress, if you think we need more agricultural workers and we keep mechanizing it anyway, let's hire more immigration agents to police the system. Because back in the late 70s, we saw something happening in New York that was alarming. We had a bunch of people. Not from Mexico. Immigration is not about Mexico, folks, or even Latin America. It's another one of the lies. We had a bunch of Jamaicans and Panamanians and Trinidadians coming to the United States ostensibly to work on the citrus groves of Florida and the apple orchards in upstate New York. And either they worked for a week or two and then decided the work was too hard, or they never worked there at all, but there was nobody to follow up to make sure that they really went to the farms. But they were legally admitted at the airport, And they said, I'm going to upstate New York to work on the farm. Here's my passport. Here's a visa. I'm on my way. We admitted them, and they disappeared. Well, they came to our attention because shortly after they disappeared, they got involved with a different cash crop. It was marijuana, and then some of them progressed to cocaine. And then they decided they needed to make even more money, and they were very violent. We had shootings all over the place. So some of them got fake ID from recruiters in the Marine Corps who were short on their quota for recruitment, and they were getting these people into the Marine Corps. They were learning, they were getting tactical and weapons training, and then they went AWOL with machine guns. They were carrying out commando-style bank robberies all over New York City. Understand what we're talking about. How many times can we see the same nonsense play out and not react to it? So we created an ad hoc group. It was myself and a couple of the other guys from immigration with the New York City Police Department, with alcohol, tobacco, and firearms because of the machine guns. And then we brought in what was then Naval Intelligence to go after the recruiters who had recruited illegal aliens and provided them with false identity documents. And we mopped it up, but not before a lot of people were badly wounded or killed. So please understand, when I talk about this stuff, it's not the superficial. And then I hear this nonsense, anybody who runs the border is an invader. Anybody who can make that statement doesn't know what it's like to be hungry. You have a lot of desperate people. They don't belong here. I've arrested them. I never saw them as my enemy. Yes, I've arrested murderers and drug dealers. I arrested terrorists, and that's why the 9/11 Commission contacted me and invited me to go to Washington to give them a deposition, which I did. I considered it my a privilege as well as my duty to do so. But I'm not speaking from a position of conjecture. I was there. I found one guy working at a glass shop who had escaped from a federal penitentiary. He had committed a murder, spent time in jail. He was deported, came back. We prosecuted him for reentry. He escaped from a jail. So when you have somebody in custody and you don't know who he is, that's a problem. And they're dangerous for that reason. You know, you can't tell a good guy from a bad guy without a scorecard, undocumented meaning no scorecard. But so many people live in abject squalor. And they do so because their countries have no need to do any better for them, because they're happy when their people leave their home country and come to America or go to some other country and send back money. In fact, Mexico, according to the Mexico News, last month was a banner month for remittances. It was 10% higher than any other month in the past. They got over last year, well, I guess it was last year, they got over $40 billion, Mexico alone, not only from America, but elsewhere, but most of their people work in America. $40 billion went from their workers in foreign countries into the Mexican economy. It's an infusion of cash. We're bleeding, and they're soaking it up. So they're happy that their people are traveling around the world and working. Principally, they're coming to America from Mexico. But that hurts our economy. And if you speak to economists, we talk about something called the multiplier effect. You know, every dollar that you put into the economy generates $3 more in commerce. If I buy a pair of shoes, the shoe salesman takes his paycheck and buys a refrigerator. The guy that sold the refrigerator goes on vacation. The guy that works at the hotel that gets the tip from the guy that's on vacation buys a car. So the money keeps circulating. Well, when people send money out of the economy, the multiplier effect is gone. So $40 billion really is the equivalent of $120 billion. Gone. No multiplier effect. The money is just swept away. Not here. See ya. So when people said, Trump said that the Mexicans were going to pay for the wall, well, they did. Because if you cut down on the remittances, you know, I compare a border wall, by the way, to insulation on your house. If you go to get your house insulated, they're going to tell you it pays for itself. Well, how does insulation pay for itself? Well, if you have good insulation, your heating bill is lower in the wintertime and your air conditioning bill is lower in the summertime. It pays for itself. And that wall also insulates us from drugs and terrorists and violence. So when people say Mexico didn't pay for the wall, my answer is, oh, yes, they did. Maybe not directly, but it doesn't much matter. They did pay for the wall. But again, these are all parts of the lies that we're told. And then we're told that if we have to have people reunited, we have to give everybody green cards and a path to citizenship. There's something known as a tourist visa. And I could tell you, having stood in that booth at the airport for 4 years, that when it was Christmas or Hanukkah, Easter, Passover, whatever the holidays, we would have a lot of people coming to the United States, and you'd say, what's the purpose of your visit? And they came from England. They came from Australia. They came from Japan. They came from everywhere in the world. What's the purpose? And amazingly, so many would say, oh, my brother became an American years ago, and we're just coming to visit with his family for 2 weeks. So they come on a tourist visa. They celebrate the holiday. They go to a wedding. They go to a bar mitzvah. They go to a confirmation, whatever. God forbid they go to a funeral, and then they go home. One of my kids lives in the middle of the country. We've yet to visit him because of COVID, but we do plan to visit, but we're not going to move in with him. He's married. He has 2 children. He's doing really well. I'm proud of all my kids. So we plan to go visit, and then we're going to come home. So if people want to talk about reuniting families, there's nothing to prevent someone from getting a tourist visa and spending a month with his brother or sister or whomever, having a good time and getting on an airplane and going back to their home country. Now, no one ever talks about tourist visas that way, but that's why people can get a tourist visa. You're here temporarily. You're not allowed to work, and you can go and visit and go to the movies and go wherever you want to go and visit with family. But we never have that conversation. Because the goal is to flood as many people into America as possible, because that's what the U.S. Chamber of Commerce wants. And when you look at refugees and Joe Biden, go ahead. I'm sorry, James.
No, what I was going to say, Mike, and it just sprung into my head, and that's going to sound kind of sensational. The way that you're talking about this, and I defer to your good judgment. You know what I think as far as your expertise goes. It seems to me almost that the United States government, in a way, is a very large, deep-pocketed, silent partner with these cartels in the human trafficking industry.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because now we're going to get to this whole thing about the immigration delivery system and the article that I just wrote for Front Page Magazine, okay? But I want to just finish about the delivery system, and then I want to get to my front page article, because that goes perfectly with what you just said. So immigration used to be a law enforcement system. And if you go to Title 8, United States Code, Section 1182, or you can read my articles, because I always include these sections of law with a link so you could read the section. Look, if we're going to have opinions, folks, we need to base it on facts. I am so sick and tired of bumping into people and getting into conversations. And then they'll come up with some harebrained idea. And I'll say, where'd you get that from? I've heard, they say, I want to know who I've heard is. They who? Okay? And by the way, you see this on the news all the time. Why do you have talking heads? And I don't care what the network is. Yammering away about something like immigration or any other, you know, real area where you need expertise, because we're talking about national security here, folks. This isn't like, did you like the movie? Yeah, it was a stupid plot. Oh, okay. Okay. Anybody could have that conversation. How was the pizza? It was all right, but the crust was lousy. Okay. You don't need expertise to do that. If you're going to talk about immigration, which is a major element of national security, as far as I'm concerned, you shouldn't be running your mouth unless you can come up with articulable facts. And, you know, I've been on programs where they ask me about the military. And my answer is I was never in the military. Not my area. I won't get into it. There was one guy on who was on with Laura Ingraham. I've been on Laura's show a couple of times. And he was there to talk about COVID. And she started to ask him about something else. And he said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to answer that question. I came on to talk about COVID. I'm not equipped to answer the question you just asked me. And I thought, good for you. But I remember Charles Krauthammer, and I had tremendous respect for Krauthammer. If you remember, he was paralyzed, and he turned lemons into lemonade. And he was inspirational, and he was brilliant. But I have to tell you, there were times he got over his skis. They all do. Because they were having this conversation on the set. I'm screaming at my TV. I wished I was on the set. And, you know, after 9/11, I was averaging over 30 television interviews per month on all the networks. And then all of a sudden, around 2007, bango, that stopped. because that was when the Chamber of Commerce went to Congress and said, all these measures on border security are costing us a fortune, knock it off. And as much as we hate the lobbyists, do you realize that the politicians are the employees of the lobbyists? I mean, think about the employer-employee relationship. The employer writes the check, the employee cashes the check. So who's writing the check? The lobbyists. Who's cashing the check? They're employees, the politicians, right? Think about that. So Charles Krauthammer said, well, if these folks have been living here for 8 years, they've never been arrested, of course it makes good sense to let them stay. Well, first of all, there is something known as, it used to be called termination of deportation. Now I believe it's suspension of removal is the term for it. But if you're here more than X number of years, you can demonstrate that your presence is important to either a resident alien or a U.S. citizen, you can ask to be given lawful permanent status here. And I don't have a problem with that either. It's almost like a statute of limitations because we should do that with other things, too, in some ways. I'm not one of these, all or nothing, iron fist nonsense. We're dealing with people. I get that. But what Charles Krauthammer said, someone needed to explain. But it went unexplained, and suddenly we're back to this business. I heard it on TV, so it must be true. How much garbage do they sell in the store with a little label on the shrink wrap that says, as seen on TV, and that gives the product all kinds of credibility, right? I'm convinced you could market freeze-dried dog poop, put it in fancy packaging, and slap a label as seen on TV, and people will buy it, right? The TV is very powerful.
Absolutely.
So he said, if they're living here for 8 years, here's my question that I would love to have asked Charles Krauthammer. May he rest in peace. Again, I'm not trying to knock the guy. I thought he was terrific. But this is what the problem is. Simple question. How do you know how long an illegal alien has been living in the United States? And if you're dealing with millions, do you really think you could interview these people? Forget about a field investigation. So everyone knows what they have to put down, just like the Dreamers. How many people to this day think Dreamers are all young kids? See, if Obama had said, if you're a child under the age of 18 and you have school records and an ID, come to an immigration office, we'll try to work something out, I might have supported that. Okay? However, the cutoff for the Dreamers is age 35 under the DREAM Act, and then with the Dreamers under Obama was age 31, but the clock has been running. So when people say, we're going to send them back to a country they don't know. Really? Anybody who was up to 35 years of age when they tried to push the DREAM Act through could have said, I entered before I was 16. Here I am now. Why 35? Because demographers estimated that 90% of the illegal alien population was younger than 35 years of age. Understand that. So it really wasn't about children. They had to claim it. And the approval rate for the Dreamers was something like 98%. Why? You think there was no fraud? Of course there was fraud. There was no way of determining it. And what you also need to know is that if you're an adjudicator, it only takes minutes to approve an application. It could take days or longer to deny one, and you're going to need an investigator to go out and knock on doors. They don't have any. So when they say we're going to clear up the backlog, lots of luck. So Alejandro Mayorkas is coming back, which is how we got into this end of this conversation, who is running Citizenship and Immigration Services, ordered his people to approve everything that landed on their desks. And they complained. And he called it get to yes. This is Alejandro Mayorkas under Obama. He fired a woman who ran a major field office. She had, I believe, a master's degree in government administration. She was there for decades. And initially, I was talking to 60 Minutes. They said, if there's someone on the inside, then we'll do this. Well, we had everything set up. And then they said, is this really an important story? And 60 Minutes killed the story. What do you think of that? They approached me after 9/11. They wanted me to come on and talk about how 9/11 happened, and I couldn't do it because I still had a badge in my pocket, but I must have had 30 phone calls with their producers the week before 60 Minutes aired a perfect article about the attacks of 9/11. But now suddenly everyone has amnesia. When was the last time you heard anybody talk about the 9/11 attacks? I had big issues with Donald Trump's inability to communicate. when he asked Joe Biden, Joe, can you say law enforcement? I was done. I was going to teach debate on the college level. If I asked that question of an opponent on my high school team, they would have thrown me off the team. If I did that on the college team, they would have thrown me out of the building. What he needed to ask Joe Biden is a very simple question. Hey, Joe, have you read the 9/11 Commission report? Because that lays everything out. No one even talks about that. Refugees are a big deal for the 9/11 report. How do we adjudicate the applications? How do we determine that these people don't pose a threat? Think of how many terrorists had claimed political asylum. The Tsarnaev brothers who attacked the Boston Marathon, their family came from Russia. They get it. They say, we can't go back to Russia. Why not? They're going to persecute us. So we gave them political asylum. About 3 weeks later, or whatever it was, they voluntarily got on airplanes and went back to Russia. So what did Bob Goodlatte, the Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, do? Oh, we need a new law that if you go back to your country after you claim asylum, unless there was a regime change, we can prosecute you. Did we need that law? Absolutely not. Because if you lie on an application, that's all you need. And by the way, lying on an application that involves terrorism calls for 25 years in jail maximum punishment. So it's pretty obvious if you say, I can't go back, and you go back, you lied. You don't need a separate law. But that's the game they play rather than hire more agents to conduct the investigations. They don't want more agents because more agents are going to find not only illegal aliens, but crooked lawyers and crooked employers. Think about that. So if a crowd harbor says, well, if they've been living here for X number of years, how do you know? You run the border, there's no record of entry that's created. All the person has to say is, I've been here for 8 years. They could have gotten here 8 hours ago. Without the ability to conduct a field investigation, you're going to have to approve the application. Because that guy's going to go to court with his lawyer, and the lawyer's going to say, my client was denied his benefit, and it's not fair. And most judges are going to say, well, where's the evidence from immigration that they can't approve the application? The absence of proof isn't proof of something else. And that's a problem. So Mayorkas ordered people to approve applications. ABC News did an amazing story about it. I wrote about this article, in my article for Front Page Magazine about Mayorkas, and I said that under Biden, he's going to create the Department of Homeland Surrender. The complaint from the employees at Citizenship and Immigration Services is that they were ordered to approve applications that shouldn't have been approved, and it was determined by the Inspector General that he had politicized his position, that he had approved applications that shouldn't have been approved. This woman was demoted and put in a different job for refusing to approve applications that never should have been approved. And the Office of Inspector General backed it up and said he did this specifically. They limited it, but I was told it was across the board, with the treaty investor petitions, the EB-5s, which have been used by spies and terrorists to enter the United States. And political asylum, again, you look at the Boston bombing. You look at the guy that set off the bomb. These are all people that got citizenship. They got immigration benefits. In fact, do you know that when our guys raided the Bin Laden compound, I looked at some of the inventory. It was in public media. And they found a copy of the 9/11 Commission report and an application for U.S. citizenship. Most of the terrorists that have come here got citizenship because now they have two passports so they can conceal their identities when they travel around the world. This is a really big deal. Why didn't the Republicans attack Mayorkas for the fact that the Office of Inspector General found that he was guilty of using his authority inappropriately? Why was that not part of the confirmation process? So Mayorkas is now the director of the entire Department of Homeland Security, the guy who told his people to get to yes. And the guy that's going to be in charge of the inspectors and the Border Patrol is the guy who has Tucson police chief said, I'm not going to help immigration. So what we really have is an immigration delivery system. That's why it's not working. It's working perfectly. It delivers an unlimited supply of cheap exploitable labor, including people with visas, not just the illegals, an unlimited supply of foreign tourists. That's why we keep expanding the visa waiver program, even after the 9/11 Commission warned about visa issues. It also delivers an unlimited supply of foreign students. Over 8,000 schools are authorized to bring in foreign students. We don't even know if half those schools exist. And we've been educating our adversaries like Chinese engineers and programmers. And here's the real biggie, an unlimited supply of clients for immigration law firms. Comprehensive immigration reform was never designed to get the aliens out of the shadows. You hire agents to do that. Comprehensive immigration reform was designed to convince aliens to go to immigration lawyers to get lawful status in the United States if they could have passed that bill. It's the lawyer employment program. And that's why comprehensive reform would have paid the legal fees for the aliens. I'm filing my tax return. I just got back from my accountant. He's expensive. No one pays my accountant for me. But yet illegal aliens under comprehensive reform would have had free legal help. Why? Because lawyers don't like to work for free. This is all about feathering their nests. Bob Goodlatte, the former chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, was an immigration lawyer, and I'm sure he's practicing immigration law again. And what did he specialize in? H-1B visas. And what did he push when he was in the House Judiciary Committee? Increasing the number of H-1B visas. And when I had an argument with him about it, they said, you know, my first wife was a brilliant computer programmer. She graduated Phi Beta Kappa, MBA in computer science. She was a member of the National Math Honor Society. Tragically, she died 35 years ago of cancer. And I said, most of the people who worked for her had comparable academic credentials. He said, well, my son knows a lot about computers, too, and he'd love to have tens of thousands of brilliant Indian programmers. I said, why? Are Indians brilliant and Americans are stupid? What are the Americans, chopped liver congressmen? Mr. Cutler, our meeting is done. Go look up Bobby Goodlatte, Bob Goodlatte's son. He made a gazillion dollars working with Zuckerberg at Facebook. This is about making certain that we get rid of American workers, just like Disney did, just like Con Edison in California did. Fire the Americans, bring in the Indians, because they will work for one-third or one-quarter the wage that an American would accept. Think about what's going on. So when you hear these politicians saying, oh, we need to bring in the world's best and brightest. I almost had a fist fight with Ted Cruz over that. He actually pushed me, and it almost got very ugly very quickly. And I told him, I said, you know something? I'm from Brooklyn, and where I come from, we have a term for the world's best and brightest. We call them Americans. And that was what set Mr. Cruz off. Now, look, does that mean we shouldn't bring in talented people from other countries? No, absolutely we should. Look, we brought in war criminals to help our space program. Werner von Braun was a Nazi war criminal. Okay? Am I wrong?
Oh, and all his guys that came with him were, too.
From Peenemünde. Yes, they decided to surrender to the Allies because they thought they would have an easier time than with the Russians because these people weren't killing Russians, were killing Russians, not Americans, so they figured the Americans would go easier on them. But I want you to all think about this. And you know, for years they kind of concealed this, and more is being written about it. Nat Geo did an interesting story about Werner von Braun. He built two rockets. One was actually a jet, the V-1. We're getting a little technical. I hope you folks out there find aviation interesting. It's a passion for both James and for myself. But the V-1 had a ramjet engine, and it made a buzzing sound, and that's why they called it the buzz bomb. And basically, it looked like a cruise missile. It had the engine on the back on top of the fuselage. It had two wings like an airplane, the small tail, and they would just launch it in the general direction of London. And there was enough fuel in it to carry it over London. And when it ran out of fuel, it would just kind of nose over and hit the ground and blow up because there was a bomb in the nose of every one of these things. Now, we worry about collateral damage, civilian casualties. And in fact, we've built cruise missiles that are so amazing. And I've seen demonstrations or videos where they could actually program the cruise missile to go through the third window from the left on the fourth floor of a factory and take out that part of the building. The V-1 was just a bomb that landed in the middle of a civilian population. It was a terror weapon. The V-2 was the first actual rocket, and the Redstone that launched Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom, and before them, the Chimp Ham on a suborbital flight, is a direct descendant of the V-2, which was a liquid-fueled rocket that went up and came down. The difference was the V-2 made no noise before it hit. The Brits could hear the V-1 coming, and they were able to shoot it down in some cases. In some cases, I saw footage of Spitfires chasing it and shooting it down before it could get over the civilian population. The
right.
V-2 was silent. It went up and came down on a ballistic trajectory, and it was silent. Truly remarkable. And the story behind that, again, is the stupidity of America. I don't know if you remember the background behind the V-2, but there was a scientist by the name of Robert Goddard in the United
yes.
States in 1926, built the first liquid-propelled rocket engine. It's an
a pioneer.
Contraption. The nozzle was on top and the fuel tanks below to give it stability, I guess. They have a model of it at the Air and Space Museum. And the Americans said, we don't need that. What's that going to do? So he peddled it to Germany, and von Braun and company picked up on it and said, wow, this is what we need, because under the Geneva Accord, they were limited to how many guns they could have and how many tanks and all this other business. But there was nothing in the Geneva Accord about rockets. So along comes Goddard, along comes von Braun and a couple of other Nazis. And so we brought von Braun and company to America, and they kept them, and they sequestered them, you know. They said, you're not going anywhere. This is over in, I think it was Huntsville initially. And so over time, they became trusted, et cetera, and they got us to the moon. But I remember Bob Hope making a joke about it, saying that he went to Russia, and he told the Russians he was so impressed with their manned space program, and he said he wanted to congratulate their scientists, but he didn't know how to speak German. And the audience, of course, laughed. And I'm thinking, you dummy. And I met Bob Hope. What a gentleman. An amazing experience. Great American. But I'm thinking, dummy, our scientists speak German also. You know. but the point of the matter is we've always wanted to bring people here who are unique. Think about Albert Einstein. Think about Elon Musk. And the other side will always say that. You wouldn't have brought Einstein here? Of course. Edward Teller came here. I met Edward Teller at the airport, in fact. He was the father of the H-bomb.
Wow.
Of course. Yes. And a funny story is I took a class in military history, and one night I was going through my desk drawer. I was an inspector at the airport at the time, and I was cleaning out my drawer, and I found this report that I wrote for military history. My teacher was the commanding general of the Hungarian army during the uprising, Bela Karali, believe it or not, at Brooklyn College. And I got an
wow.
A on my paper about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I was wondering, whatever happened to Edward Teller? He's the only person still alive that I wrote about. Picture this one. 12 hours later, I'm in my booth at Kennedy Airport, and guess who walks into my booth? Edward Teller. I almost fell over. How's that for a kawinky dink?
Get him to help you with
your homework?
Is,
I should have. But the point is, no one's suggesting that we don't try to bring in the most brilliant. But when you're bringing in an army of hundreds of thousands of foreign workers, the only thing exceptional about them is their willingness to work for exceptionally low wages under exceptionally adverse conditions. But then I wrote an article, and this brings us to what you were asking me about the cartels. So I hope after the program, first of all, go to the American Conservative and check out my article, Biden Amps Up the Immigration Delivery System, and the subtitle, The Refusal to Declare a Border Crisis is More Than a Matter of Semantics. I mean, this is what they want. This is a failure by design, okay? But the other article that I think you would like, and this is in frontpagemag.com, it was just published April 30th, just 3 days ago. Or 4 days ago, Profiteers of Biden Administration Open Borders Policy, the subtitle, Malfeasance Has Its Rewards. So now, understand what's happened. And if you want to talk about the money and the incentives for the problems that we have, I mentioned Tom Tancredo a little bit earlier. I testified for Tom about the nexus between immigration failures and 9/11 before the Immigration Reform Caucus. In November 2001. I was fired the next day, by the way. I got a notice that because I had injured my leg, I was home with a screwed up knee. I got hurt three times, you know, making arrests of the contact sport. And I offered to go back on duty. I said, look, the only thing I hurt is my knee, not my head, not my hands, not my brain. I can still do everything except chase people. I can walk, but I'm not very good climbing a whole bunch of stairs or engaging in a chase. But my goodness, I spent 4 years working at the intelligence division at DEA. I could be a training officer. I could do work as an analyst. Nope, we're done. We don't need you. Yeah, they were upset because they knew I was talking to Congress. I had worked with Al D'Amato to create the aggravated felon reentry law that made unlawful reentry for criminal aliens a 20-year felony. So they weren't very happy with me. How dare you? You know, you're taking this job seriously, I guess, you know. God help us all. But Tom Tancredo had suggested that we ought to be taxing the remittances, the money being wired out of the United States to other countries. So here's where it gets interesting. Back then, there was a guy by the name of Charlie Fote. And Charlie Fote was the CEO of First Data Corporation. His office was located in Atlanta, Georgia. First Data Corporation, follow the bouncing ball, was the parent company to Western Union. Charlie Fote didn't like the idea that they were going to propose taxing the money, because perhaps fewer people would be using wire service and just smuggling money out of the country and appliances and couches and everything else like they'd always been doing. In fact, you go to the bad neighborhoods, we have lots of illegal aliens, and you see a lot of dentistry places, gold buying services. Why? Because it's easy to convert drug money to gold and then move the gold between countries. If you're going to move, you know, we used to issue $1,000 bills. You know, they don't make $1,000 bills anymore, because it makes it too easy to move large sums of money under the radar. So $100 bills are the biggest that they now print. It used to be $1,000 bills. So they said, we have to make it unwieldy. But you could always convert money to diamonds, or convert money to gold or some other precious materials and move it that way. They get very creative with all this thing about moving the money. And so Charlie Fote was really upset with Tom Tancredo when he said, let's tax the remittances. So he moved his office from Atlanta to Colorado, next door to where Tom Tancredo's district was, and they were creating a political action committee to try to unseat Tancredo. It's all about the money. If you drive down Roosevelt Avenue in a neighborhood called Jackson Heights in Queens, New York, that used to be all Colombian-controlled turf. I know I was up there doing surveillance and making arrests with DEA. Again, the advantage that I bring to the table is that I not only did immigration investigations, but narcotics and terrorism investigations. And I could go on forever about the things that we saw. We had people opening up post boxes, you know, letter boxes are us. And what they did was they would communicate that way without anybody knowing it. It's not going through the post office. They would send parcel package to a mailbox that's not under the control of the postal authorities. And the address they would give is another post box somewhere else. And the address for the other post box was somewhere in the middle of the Hudson River. It was a non-existent address. And these were the Colombian drug traffickers. All right? So you saw all the tricks that were being used to stay under the radar. And this, of course, is before we got to computers and everything else where we are today. You know, in the old World War II movies, they had little microfilm. Today, you could hand somebody a memory stick, and the darn thing could be a whole library, right? Think about that.
Exactly.
So the whole thing is to stay under the radar. That was why bin Laden stopped using his cell phone, and I predicted it. The way they got to bin Laden was he was using a courier, and they eventually figured out who the courier was. Stay under the radar. Become primitive. Don't always go high-tech. Sometimes low-tech works better. So in any event, the whole point was to move the money. And if you went to Roosevelt Avenue, the Colombians controlled it. And then at some point, the Colombians decided, you know, this isn't working for us because the Americans are working with the Colombian government, and we were reaching into Colombia and prosecuting the cartels in Colombia, the Medellin cartel and so forth. So what did they do? They started to work with the Mexicans. And we were also going after their speedboats that were coming up through the Atlantic into Florida. Think about the TV show Miami Vice. That's how a lot of the drugs were moving, on speedboats. So we used the Navy and we used the Coast Guard, and we were interdicting the boats. So they were losing a lot of their drugs that way. And they said, you know what? We'll put the drugs through Mexico the Mexicans will get half the profit, but they will insulate us from law enforcement. And that's how the Mexican cartels began. And think about El Chapo Guzman. So where does El Chapo Guzman, the most prolific and violent Mexican drug smuggler, set up shop? In New York City, the city with the biggest police department. Why? Well, New York is a border town. I know, you always think, you know, those four border towns, four border states. Well, New York has access to the Canadian border. We have seaport, and we have international airports. So New York hits the trifecta for border states. And so he moved his operation to New York because of the cartel and because of the sanctuary policies. And he was put on trial in Brooklyn, New York, just a couple of blocks, a couple of miles from Chuck Schumer's house, New York City. Not San Antonio, not Dallas, not Phoenix, Arizona, Brooklyn, New York. Understand what we're talking about, folks. And so it's all about the money. And if you go down Roosevelt Avenue, there are money wire services, three, four, five of them on one block for miles. You know, when I was in Minnesota, I did a ride along with the sheriffs. This was about 10 years ago, and they showed me three money wire services. They said, look at what we have to deal with. I said, three? I could take you to New York, and you'll have double that on one block, and then it stretches for miles. We probably have 100 and some odd money wire, and they operate 24/7, big flashing lights. Do you really think that some guy working as a dishwasher is going in at 3 in the morning to send money back home? No. These are people that are consummating drug deals. And then there was an article that caught my eye because of what's been happening since Biden took office. Kidnapping has gone through the roof. And I've said that about these children that are coming across the border. And the first thing we heard is, these parents are renting out their kids. Well, maybe some of them are. Possible. But does anyone realize that maybe these kids are being kidnapped, especially infants? How do you interrogate a three-month-old baby or an eight-month-old baby? There was that article about this convicted thug who had been deported and was caught wading the Rio Grande about a year ago with a six-month-old baby in his arms that wasn't his baby. Do you really think you could sit that kid down and say, is this guy your father? He's 6 months old. God only knows who the parents are. That kid will probably never be reunited with his parents, okay? Now they're getting bolder. And I was part of the anti-smuggling unit in New York in the late 1970s. And they weren't as violent as they are now, but some of them were really bad even back then. Women were taking birth control pills months before they came to America. Why? Because they expected to be gang raped. I've been down to the border. You see the rape trees. The rape trees is the nickname for these bushes where you go there and you see maybe 100 sets of women's panties hanging from the branches on these bushes. They called it a rape tree because the smugglers would rip the clothing off these women and they would gang rape them. We're talking about brutality you can't imagine. And so they would smuggle some guy, and they say, give us $2,000, we'll get you to New York. They put him in a safe house. They say, well, the fee just went up. Well, what do you mean it went up? I gave you $2,000. Yeah, well, I want another $2,000. So they would be held at gunpoint, and they just had a case like that in Texas, 100 people in one house. Picture that scene, held at gunpoint, and they were told, get a hold of your family and have them wire us money. Vice did a story, the website Vice. They also have a TV program, V-I-C-E. It turns out that companies, believe it or not, it blew my mind, like Walmart are wiring money. And who are they wiring the money to? The kidnappers and the rapists and the cartels. Now, let's go a little further. It turns out that they've been hearing, they've been writing about this, how Iran, through Hezbollah, which started in Lebanon, but it's funded and directed by Iran, it's a terrorist organization, is working in close coordination with the human smugglers, the drug cartels, to move drugs and people into the United States to fund terrorism and also sleeper agents. And now today, breaking news, I don't know if you saw it, James, but now it's been confirmed by the intelligence services. Guess where Al-Qaeda is now operating? In Iran. Just take a deep breath and put those dots together. Let that sink in. We're in the middle of a nuclear negotiation that never should have gotten where it is, right? Israel is thoroughly alarmed, and so am I.
Jesus whip.
And now, so they have nuclear materials, and they have ISIS and Al-Qaeda operating within their borders. What's to prevent them? They don't even need a bomb to give them nuclear materials to create a dirty bomb in the United States. You've got those terrorists operating in Iran right now, and we're going to
hell, Michael. They may already have. They may already have.
Probably here in a garage somewhere. And then you have this thing with China and Blinken. Boy, what an appropriate name, Winken, Blinken, and Nod. Right? Blinken said that the purpose of the administration isn't to try to contain China, but to get them to basically play by the rules. That's like telling Al Capone to make sure that his loan sharks don't charge exorbitant interest rates. Our enemies have never been happier than they are right now. We have never been
agreed.
In a more dangerous and precarious position than we are right now. So you've got the cartels getting the money through Walmart and these other companies that are moving the money. And do you think that they care where the money is going? Of course not. Of course not. They're just rolling in the money. All they care about, you know, the communists used to say the capitalists will sell you the rope with which you will hang them. Folks, we're having a fire sale on rope in this country. And if you connect all those dots and you look at Biden saying there's no crisis on the border, and according to the Vice article, in the last decade, $800 million was wired to the kidnappers and human traffickers. But now, of course, it's been amped up immeasurably because of what Biden is doing and not doing. How long do you think this is going to go on? And let's put things in proper perspective. On September 11, 2001, more people died at the hands of 19 hijackers than America lost to the Japanese fleet at Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, and the death count from 9/11 continues. In fact, just 2 days ago, I drove by a church on my way to take my wife to work. She works at a synagogue near this church. And the fire trucks were out, the firemen were there in their dress uniforms and their turnout gear also to honor another fallen fireman. And to my knowledge, no one has died recently in a fire in New York, thankfully. I would not doubt that this poor person who died, this first responder, this firefighter, probably yet another victim to 9/11. More people have died after 9/11 because of illnesses as a result of the toxins they ingested that were actually killed on 9/11. Think about that. And so what does it take to figure out that the damage that could be done by a handful of people, that's why it's called asymmetrical warfare, is inestimable. And nobody is making that connection, the terrorists with the refugees, with open borders, with driver's licenses for illegal aliens. Think about this. I don't know of any other time that an airplane has been used in a terror attack since 9/11. I know there were one or two that was disrupted where airplanes were part of the plan, but to my knowledge, there has not been a single terror attack since 9/11 involving airplanes. Around the world, how were the attacks carried out? By motor vehicles. The attack in 93 at the CIA involved a courier van that the terrorist had bought a partnership in. A month later, the Trade Center bombing involved two illegal aliens. The guy that drove it was a visa violator. The guy who rented the truck was a visa violator. The people that were mowed down on the west side by a truck, by a terrorist, just three blocks from 9/11, from Ground Zero, again, a truck. If you look at Europe, trucks and cars. If you look at Washington and other major cities around the United States, what do they put up? Concrete barriers, big flower planters. Why? Because they're there to protect against car bombs and truck bombs. But we have no idea who's behind the wheels of those vehicles. How much stupider, how much more of a betrayal could this be of America and Americans? We've lost almost every expectation of privacy and freedom in the name of national security. And I have to tell you, when I look at what is now happening, with the way that our government is conducting itself against the so-called white supremacists, and saying that that's a bigger threat than international terrorism. And, you know, when they passed the Patriot Act, they asked me what I thought of it. And I said, you know, I really don't care what we do to a terrorist, okay? You can hang him out the door of an airplane by his short hairs, but here's the problem. Is he really a terrorist or is he not a terrorist? Who's going to make that call? And the answer is you don't know. So back up a second. Should we be hanging people out of an airplane by the short hairs if we're not sure who we're even dealing with? Some guy will tell you, oh, that guy's a terrorist. Just like you had people saying that Donald Trump was doing whatever and it turned out to be completely bogus. I always worry about the information that you get from an informant. I have many informants. Informants remind me what my dad said to me about women when I was a young boy. He said, Mike, bad with them, worse without them. And we used to laugh about it. And of course, he was teasing. My father was so respectful of women and particularly my mom. But the point is, informants are problematic. So first of all, there's a reason that you're innocent until proven guilty in America. Second of all, enhancing penalties and tactics against terrorists may sound like a good idea, and sometimes I think, you know, you have very few choices. I mean, if lives are hanging in the balance, there's a bomb that's about to go off. You know, we've all seen these scenarios. But my bigger concern is the way that they passed the RICO statutes, the racketeering statutes, were passed under the Kennedy administration by his brother Robert Kennedy to go after organized crime, the racketeers. Do you know that many more people have been prosecuted for racketeering that had no link to racketeering than members of the mob were? Because somehow prosecutors will always take these tools that we give them for one purpose and use them for a totally different purpose. That maybe isn't such a good idea. We've got to really understand that we are a nation of law. And the more that we see this insanity that plays out, where you have members of Congress threatening to burn down cities if we don't get a certain verdict in a trial, as far as I'm concerned, that should have resulted in an arrest for inciting to riot and everything else under the sun. And the judge and the trial over George Floyd and what I saw was reprehensible. Let me be clear about this. I'm not trying to explain away what we saw. But there's a system of justice that we deal with. And what was that famous line? I'd rather see 10 guilty men go free than put one innocent man in jail. We need to respect this notion that you are protected by this principle of you're innocent until proven guilty. And so what we're seeing now is a perversion of the entire criminal justice system when you can have someone like Maxine Waters out there basically threatening mayhem if a jury doesn't come back with a conviction. I don't care how strongly you feel about a case. It's supposed to be a deliberative process. That's why the jury enters into a deliberation. You know, I sat on a couple of juries, amazingly, even though I was in law enforcement. In one case, it was a drug case, and we convicted the guy. I mean, they had him 8 ways from Sunday. Another, there was a claim of sexual assault, and the conflicting witness statements made it impossible to convict. You look at the evidence, you look at the law, and you're supposed to try to make the best decision that's fair and honest and moral. And when you have politicians that are threatening people to make certain that we manipulate the judicial system in a certain way to get an outcome that they want. That's what you do in third world dictatorships, not what you do in this country, the United States of America, that has served as the role model for the world. It is alarming to me. It is alarming to me. I understand the outrage. I understand the anger. But again, we have got to deal with each trial and understand, you know, when I was on those juries, 2 jury cases, the judge, each time when they charged the jury, said something that I want everyone to think about. Every time there's a trial, it's not only the defendant who is on trial, but it is our system of justice that is on trial. And we, the people, have got to take back control of our government from people that we elected to supposedly uphold the Constitution and look out for our best interests. when a politician can stand there and say, we're going to bring in the world's best and brightest, and we're not talking about a handful of true exceptional people, but an army of foreign workers, then that politician needs to be led to the unemployment line, and the quicker the better. Am I making sense to you here, I hope, James?
Totally. Totally, yes.
And I want you folks to know something my dad said to me. He said, Mike, you're going to teach people how they should treat you by demonstrating what you're willing to accept. And we've been accepting so much garbage for so long, shame on us. And I was on a conservative radio show a few months ago. And we got into a big argument. I'm a Democrat. I'm pretty much a centrist on a couple of issues. You would definitely say I'm a Democrat. On other issues, you'd scratch your head and say, gee, I don't know. And that's fine. I don't like labels. Because that, to me, is another form of prejudice. We're individuals and we're complex people. But I said, you know, the reason that so many Americans are willing to look, you know, at socialism as a possibility is the fault of the very wealthy. I said, because in this system, too many Americans aren't succeeding. And this guy was a real dyed-in-the-wool conservative. He said, Mike, you got to understand, under capitalism, you're guaranteed opportunity, but you're not guaranteed outcome. I said, you're no longer guaranteed opportunity in America to begin with. When you could bring in an army of foreign workers, when you're bringing in more workers every year than the number of new jobs you're creating, opportunity just went out the window. But I said, we most certainly do have a guarantee of outcome. And this guy was furious on his own radio program. He all but accused me of being a liar. He said, I challenge you for making that statement. I said, I can substantiate my statement with two simple words that prove there is a guarantee of outcome in America if you're high enough up the food chain. Golden parachutes. And all I heard from him was crickets. He had nothing to say.
Just ask Jack Welch.
Jack Welch with the 10% rule. You fire the bottom 10% and you promote the top 10% and you turn every employee against one another over corporate greed. And then they have something called cost out where they hire these young kids out of engineering school to sit at a bench and scrape away little bits of metal from the switches and circuit breakers so that what used to be a reliable item that you could go to the bank with becomes a piece of garbage. They make it fail, and then they put just enough material in that they squeak it by the UL process, Underwriter Labs. Now, I'm sorry, that's not what America's supposed to be about. When you have the head of Amazon, who is the wealthiest man in the world, turning around and saying, I'm taking away health benefits for my part-time workers. My gosh, you wonder why Americans don't believe in the economic system? There was a Princeton economist about a decade ago who said that America had gone from a republic to an oligarchy. And that's exactly where we are. It's an unholy alliance between government and corporations. I think there's a term for it. I think it's called fascism. And that's what we're experiencing. This unholy alliance, because the wealthy are getting the best government money can buy, and that court decision, Citizens United, really greased the skids that unlimited amounts of money could be pumped into campaigns. And someone said, well, that was to counter the unions. And I said, well, I have a better idea. No one should be able to make campaign contributions. If I couldn't get a cup of coffee when I was on duty, then I don't think politicians should be able to get a plug nickel. And then you listen to people like Gates over in Florida, Matt Gates, I don't take PAC money. Of course you do, Matt. Stop lying. The party gets the PAC money, and then they give it to those politicians that do their bidding. So all that the political parties are money laundering operations. You tell me I'm wrong on that one.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's what, there's a modicum of truth. He's not taking it, but his party superiors are, and they're doling it out.
And if he wants a piece of that money, he knows what he has to do to be able to get it. And
exactly.
I saw this happen to Lou Barletta because he wasn't the globalist when his party, he was running for the Senate and the Republicans defunded his campaign. He didn't have enough money to run a single TV ad. That's where we are today. We have got to get a hold of these politicians and make it clear to them that we are not the idiots that they hoped we were. We are standing at the precipice. This is an inflection point in the history of our nation. We've never been in a riskier position, and we need to get our voices heard. And please don't look at the little R or the little D and say, oh, that's who I'm voting for. We need to know where they stand, because there was the Republicans who started the open borders long before the Democrats. In fact, it was Bernie Sanders in 06 who said that anybody who hires illegal aliens should be prosecuted because they're destroying wages and jobs for Americans. Now, boy, how did he flip? And the same thing with Sheila Jackson Lee. Yep. I testified for Sheila twice, and she complained bitterly when Bush refused to hire as many agents as he'd been given money to, both Border Patrol and ICE agents. They gave him enough money to hire 800 new ICE agents. He cut it to 143. This was around 2005. They gave him enough money to hire 2,000 Border Patrol agents. He cut that to 210. They gave him enough money to get 8,000 detention beds, and he cut that to 1,900 and change. And she said, the president is challenging us to force him to do the right thing to protect Americans. This was Sheila Jackson Lee back then. Where do you think she sits today on that issue or stands? It's remarkable. Our government needs a new position in the cabinet, the official auctioneer. I'm personally lobbying for the Mecum Auto Auction guy because I think he does a pretty talented job. What do you think, James?
No.
But
that's what it's going to be. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been talking with it just blistered by 2 hours with our pal Mike Cutler. He's been with us. And you know, Mike, before you leave, I want you to do a couple of things. Number one, I want to thank you because with immigration, you know, now coming once again back to the fore, to the forefront of the American eye, and not in a good way. I know because I've been listening to other media how much you are in demand these days. You are back in the ascendant again. I can't tell you how happy that makes me. But beyond that, the fact that you will come here and you'll sit with us and you'll take the whole 2 hours and talk and help us unpack things and lead us to understand just how important an issue immigration and border security is, well, I can't tell you how appreciative I am of that. Where can people find you these days?
Well, lying in the sidewalk. No, I'm kidding around. I lose my sense of humor. It's all over.
All right, Phil.
Either laugh or cry. Well, my website is michaelcutler.net. I do a blog talk radio program an hour on Friday nights at 7 p.m. East Coast time, the Michael Cutler Hour. And if you go there, you can listen to my podcast from prior programs. I also write for Front Page Magazine, frontpagemag.com, and The American Conservative. But here's the deal, folks. I want you to take the information that if you like the articles, if you like the podcast, put it on social media. Forward it to your friends. Ask them to do the same thing. I'm trying to create a bucket brigade of truth. We can all arrive at different decisions, and that's what America is about, but let's base it on fact. And when you speak to your friends and neighbors, they're invested in whatever position they have. And I just saw a survey that said that Laura Ingraham's is not watched by as many people as watched Maddow at MSNBC, which blew my mind. So there's a lot of people that have been lied to, and they've been fed a lot of propaganda. Be gentle with them and ask them to consider whether or not they're concerned about the future of their children, their children's future, and the future of our nation, because that's what's on the line. And this isn't about being a racist or a bigot or a xenophobe. I'm first-generation American. And I love America because if America hadn't let my mom in, I wouldn't be here, my kids wouldn't be here, my grandchildren wouldn't be here. But we need to be careful the way a homeowner is careful about who we let in, and we need to show compassion for Americans. At some point, compassion should apply to Americans. And when you say we can't bring in all these people, that's not a statement of hatred, that's a statement of practicality. If you're throwing a party and you know what your budget is, you know that you're going to have to leave names off the list. And these are people that you like. You might love them. But you say, gee whiz, we don't have enough space. We don't have enough money. And that's what immigration's about. As it is, we admit more than 1 million lawful immigrants every year. We admit tens of millions of visitors. We're oversubscribed. We've got to get Americans back to work. And we've got to keep our country safe. And I can't imagine anybody who's rational and reasonable who doesn't believe that those are important goals for we the people. And I don't care what your party is. I don't care if you're with the Hopping Kangaroo Party.
You took us right up to the time, Mike. God bless you. You did it again. Thanks so much.
I did it again.
We appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
I'll talk to you here soon.
Okay, I look forward to it. Be well.
Thanks a lot, Michael. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Our pal, Michael Cutler, terrific guy. And, you know, he comes in here 2 hours. He gives us our money's worth. You can't catch this on David Webb. You're not going to catch this anywhere else because they're not going to give him the time that he deserves. Here he's got it, and we're grateful for him. And that was terrific. That's all the time we got, guys. God bless you. God bless America. See you next time. Service respect.